Our panel this morning, Gabrielle Colleran is a consultant paediatric radiologist at Children Health Ireland. Kevin Doyle is group head of news at Independent News and Media, and Anne-Marie Craven is a lecturer in psychology in the University of Limerick. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Gabrielle, you've just come from a very long shift at work, I believe, have you?
Yes, we had a bit of a busy night.
Yeah. So what are you seeing in there?
So the last few weeks have been very tough for us in the Children's Hospital. So we have seen a lot more RSV, which is a common chest infection that we see in babies and younger children. But we're seeing a lot more of it, and we saw it a lot earlier. And we're seeing just
do they get quite sick, some of them, with the RSV?
So some of them get very sick. October was very unusual for us because we had that run of it much earlier, and we were having kids coming in with multiple viral infections at the same time and being sicker. So it's been a very challenging time for us. I think October was our busiest month for emergency admissions on record. So it's just been very challenging. And obviously it's been really challenging for parents and for children as well, because, you know, we've had a lot of people having to stay on trolleys in the ED overnight, which, while is endemic in the adult hospitals, sadly, is not something we often have in the children's hospitals. And it's really particularly upsetting to see it, to be honest.
So it's been tough. And can their parents stay with them in the corridor or whatever?
Yeah, so the parents will be on a chair beside them. But it's very, very challenging, you know. And then the other thing is that we have a lot of staff who are now sick at the moment. You know, unfortunately, the timing of the boosters seemed to be a little bit late relative to when people's immunity was waning. So, you know, we have a lot of colleagues out with COVID. So those of us that thankfully aren't sick, and this is the reason I'm wearing the mask, we're under that bit of extra pressure because we're cross-covering for sick leave. And of course, you know, the COVID stresses and the amount of beds being taken up with COVID care is displacing all the other essential care. And we were in such a tough position going into this that the waiting lists have just exploded. And for patients who have other conditions that are just as important for them, those waits, unfortunately, are now longer, and the impact of those delays. So
are some of your colleagues getting COVID for the second time at this stage?
So some of them are, yes. Yeah. And unfortunately, some of them have ongoing symptoms that mean they haven't been able to return to work, which is extremely challenging for them and for the health system. So, you know, the long COVID, chest pain, palpitations, shortness of breath, ongoing respiratory symptoms that mean they're actually not fit for regular activities of daily living, like walking up the stairs or walking to the shop, let alone putting in hard shifts in hospitals. So, there's an urgent need really for coordinated clinics across the health system for patients with long COVID, but also for staff, because this is an occupational injury, and so it's very important that everything is done to get them back to full health.
Okay. Now, Kevin Doyle, sticking with children, you picked out that front page of the Sunday Independent today, restrictions on under 12s mixing are short term.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So obviously, as you said in your intro, Brendan, we have Micheál Martin now on the record quite publicly saying that the government fully endorse these NPHET proposals to kind of rein in the kids, if you like. And that is interesting in itself, because it was a bit unclear for the last few days. NPHET advice was out there, but it wasn't entirely sure what the government were going to do about it. So there's a cabinet meeting on Tuesday to discuss this, but he's already told us the outcome of that meeting now.
Well, I suppose the 2 weeks are practically off by the time they...
Well, that was my next point, is when does the 2 weeks start from the NPHET letter that was leaked, or does it start from the cabinet meeting on Tuesday?
I think they might be saying we go with the spirit of the 2 weeks, which could be more like 3 weeks.
And that's the other thing, because he is quoted in that piece on the front of the Sindo as saying this will be very short term and that we'll move on. And I find that kind of hard to... It's quite a brave statement by the Taoiseach, because when you read the Mail insight into the NPHET meeting where they're talking about a three-month plan, and there is, I think, whisper it, there's 27 days to Christmas. There is this sense that we all have the eye on the prize, and the prize is Christmas. But January could be a hell of a lot harder, reading all the various things across the paper today, than the next 3 weeks. So it's an interesting approach from the government. All panto season plays and all that don't go to them, but we're not cancelling them. So there's going to be a big row there, you can predict, next week. And I think, Brendan, the big thing probably is that parents are damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. Because on one hand, you good conscious citizen should keep your kids at home for the next 2 weeks. Let's say it is just 2 weeks, and they're missing out on all the other things that are going on. Some of their friends will inevitably still be doing these things, and it all becomes quite fraught. That's inevitable at home. they let them go to these events, be it playdates or parties or whatever it might be over the next few weeks, the pre-Christmas run-in. And then they're bad citizens and they're letting their little vectors, a little like lockdown one, when the kids were the vectors and everybody was terrified of kids in supermarkets.
Yeah, or you keep your kid at home because you want the schools to stay open and you don't want your kid to get COVID. I would have thought it's straightforward enough, isn't it, Anne-Marie?
Well, if I can come in on that, the schools, even though we're hearing about new initiatives to make them safer, we're still not really doing enough. So I completely agree with the column in The Independent, actually, where they call out this idea that children should make the sacrifice because children have given up enough already.
This is Fiona Sherlock.
Sherlock's column. Yeah, absolutely. So she... You know, I agree with everything she has said there, that why are the youngest paying the price?
But they're not paying the price. Everybody is having to do things. Are they paying the price any more than anyone else?
Well, some children, I'd say, Brendan, yes, they are paying the price more than everything else because I know children, for example, they might enjoy a Zoom call. And this is a really important developmental stage for children. Play is what they should be doing. And they've missed out on a lot of that already. I mean, children born at the start of the pandemic, they should be socialising now. They should be learning turn-taking, sharing. They should be seeing other children show gestures and developing their language skills. And all of that has been curtailed. And I don't know why we are asking them to do it again unless it's a last resort. So if, for example, we had air filters in schools, if we're doing everything we can in a school setting and things still aren't good, then make that message. But I don't think we're going far enough on the structural bit and we're expecting children to pick up the slack while we can go and have a pint.
Yeah, okay. Now, the I think, don't Neffet say that transmission does not occur around the whole classroom of air and that having an air filter there is not going to help. It's the kids nearest are the contacts anyway, and that a kid on the other side of the class apparently won't be
a
contact.
Well, that seems magical to me. I don't know. I don't have the relevant expertise. But
science, isn't it? I don't
know. I think there's an answer to everything.
The schools were safer, apparently, is what was actually said. Gabrielle, like, there is this kind of notion has taken hold now that the children are the ones being made to, quote, pay the price for all of this, which... I don't know. What do you make of that?
So I'd strongly endorse what Anne-Marie has just said. And I think we have to come back to, as a society, we should always be doing the most to protect our most vulnerable. And our most vulnerable are our young and our elderly. And primary school children, like yourself and myself, Brendan, like hopefully we both have a growth mindset, but we're fairly fully formed at this stage. But for kids, for their normal development, play, interaction with each other, all that socialisation, it has to happen at key times. Otherwise, the process gets a bit broken and it's very hard to repair it later on. And of course, more vulnerable children...
But like, is keeping them home for 2 weeks now are curtailing them, but they're still able to go to school.
The point that I would make is that before we have to do those additional things for them, we should be doing everything we can structurally, because it's a bit too soft on the system to put the responsibility back on parents again. And so I would agree with what Anne-Marie is saying.
But we can't expect the system to do everything for us either.
No, but the system could have HEPA filters. Could have HEPA filters in the classroom. It's a fan and a filter system. It sucks the air in, pulls the viruses and the bacteria out, puts the air back out. My principal has put them into my daughter's classroom. I feel much happier about my kids being in school.
I think there was a rush of parents got onto schools after they heard Cliona Ní Chealaigh the other day saying she bought a HEPA filter for her kids' class. I think a load of people were getting onto schools going, we'll buy a HEPA filter for
the class.
Yeah,
but remember, Brendan, again, it's parents like myself and Cliona and Anne-Marie that can afford to, that can do that. What about the kids in the JEST school? Who's putting the HEPA filter in for them? So what I'd be saying is, let's do every... Like, schools can only be as low risk as the level of community transmission we have. We're at, I think, four times the level we were at the highest time when schools were open, which was October 2020. From memory. So if we want to get the transmission down as low as possible, we need to do everything we can. It's freezing at the moment. The teachers can't have the windows full blast all the time, or the kids are going to have chill blains. So along with the carbon dioxide monitors, get the HEPA filters in, do everything we can structurally. Talk about doing outdoor play dates, have the kids well wrapped up, but expecting the kids to just pay the price for, you know, us not having gotten the planning right to this point, I personally am annoyed about it, because I feel like for small kids...
So you think this 2 week suggestion of kids not going to pantos or whatever, not going to parties and play dates and all that, you
think
this is not fair?
I think the pantos are either cancelled so that the tickets are refunded back to people, or else the pantos are going ahead. I think it's very unfair to say you've got tickets and now you're just going to waste those tickets, and you're going to have to explain to your children why they're not allowed to go but other people's children allowed to go. I think that is suboptimal compared to maximising the structural things we can do. Now, I would go along with
coalescing around here is that make this a rule.
Yeah, well, I think otherwise I think that's
for
unfair.
Business as well,
yeah.
Brendan, and that's going to be a big point this week.
Yeah,
I think,
but Panto have been given $2 million, and they're getting, they can get grants of up to $500,000. They can
it's
get
not
half
just,
their costs.
It's
back.
Not just the big Pantos though. There's things all, you know, we think about the Gaiety or wherever. It's all the little things around the country that are happening. Is and like, I have one of those lockdown babies Anne-Marie was talking about. But like I booked Santa Claus for her twice, two different Santa Clauses, and they've both, Santa Claus is not coming to town anymore. They've both pulled in the last week. Because of the uncertainty around the whole situation. So
would you be happy to bring her him it to
her,
to sorry. Her would you be happy to bring her to Santa?
At this stage, no, to be honest. To be honest, I don't think she would have been happy to go in the first place anyway. It was more the parents wanting the picture.
Yeah.
But no, like we've reached a point now where people will start to pull back and no, I wouldn't. At this stage I've given up on that idea.
But you prefer if these things were a rule.
But I think businesses are going to need that sort of certainty.
Yeah.
Because this idea of, we haven't cancelled anything. Now, we're not allowing 75% of your audience attend. But you go away and have that row with them because of the advice. So I think we need government to make it pretty black and white for people. And I know we talk about authoritarian rule and we can all make our own decisions. But there comes times where you have to lay the cards on the table. And I think if we are in the situation that certainly Neffet seems to think we are in, then we have to be straight with people.
Like, Brendan, let's be honest, like, you can but you shouldn't is a really tricky message to try to, like, you know, explain to kids who are now disappointed. But we're not allowed because the government are doing everything they possibly can to ensure that schools reopen to in-person teaching in January. That's a message that's actually understandable. And kids want to be going to school because they want to be playing with their kids in the yard. And there's, you know, so I'm not worried about Christmas. I'm really worried about January. And I'm worried about all the vulnerable kids that if schools don't reopen to in-person teaching.
But is that not what we're essentially being told? Like the school is the important thing. We'll keep them open and we want people to have a bit of cop on around it in order to
So do
that.
Everything you can to make schools as low risk as possible.
Okay,
and many of us believe that we haven't done everything we can. Now, I will comply with all the keeping my kids back from stuff, but I think that is not as good as option as having everything structurally done first. And then if you need that as well, like Anne-Marie said, you know, but that should be a last resort because we should be prioritising their development and normal play as part of that. But of course, emphasising lower risk is good. So get them outdoors, wrapped up, playing in playgrounds where it's safer, not inside on top of each other, snuggled up watching a movie.
And look, I mean, Pete Lunn was in here a week or two ago and I said to him, like, what's your big bit of advice? How could we nudge people's behaviour? And he said the same thing he said a year ago and it did work for a lot of people. Get some coats, get a good coat and get out there. What a load of nonsense. Children paying the price. A 2-week break from socialising. Get a grip. That's Margaret Price. I suspect Margaret Price is possibly an older person, maybe your grandmother or something. That kind of no-nonsense common sense. There's another texter here says, I totally agree with the comment, read damned if you do and damned if you don't. I've been shielding my 3-year-old as much as possible since the beginning of COVID. Yet at every health check with HSE, I'm being asked about his social skills, which are not where they should be because of this shielding. Okay, we're going to move on to the bigger picture now. Professor Liam Fanning, Professor of Immunovirology at UCC, is on the line. Good morning, Liam.
Good morning, Brendan.
Liam, how concerned are you about Omicron, this new variable?
I suppose what I'd do is I'd break it down into what we know about it and what we don't know about it and that kind of thing. And I suppose we've seen variants come and go in the past, okay, and some have managed to kind of come up above to the level of variant concern and be globally important, such as Alpha and Delta that we have currently. But what is interesting enough is that we had a variant called Mu that was in South America, and it was likely to be vaccine resistant, but it was actually outcompeted by Delta because Delta was a fitter virus. So viral fitness is a thing that kind of, we'll say, dominates the landscape of this kind of battle between various variants, and Delta replaced Alpha. So Delta may very well keep this particular Omicron in its box, as it were.
So why the strong... I think a lot of people wonder, as you mentioned there have been other variants of concern. This one we've seen to have reacted like never before. Why the strong reaction?
Well, I suppose the strong reaction is based on the fact that the kind of constellation of change, the kind of buttons on the outside of the coat of spike protein, so many have changed. And basically what it is like is that you've got the kind of all the different mutations or all the different colored smarties have come together in the one box.
Yeah.
and that's the kind of reason for concern. Now, they haven't all...
So is this the appropriate reaction?
Well, I suppose it's an appropriate first step in to see whether we need to come back and go back to, we'll say, a week ago, or whether we need to go forward. You know, we have some indication that it might be more transmissible, but that could be a cohort effect of maybe a couple of super spreader events.
Yeah.
There is some indication that it might be more transmissible, but that doesn't automatically translate into more disease causing. And, you know, I know there's lots of focus.
I heard a guy suggest the other night, one of your colleagues from Belgium, I think it was, but that where a virus wants to end up for itself and to survive, its instinct is to get more infectious, but not to make people sick so that they get out and spread it and everything. So, and that's where we want it to end up as well, in a way. Would we dare to hope that Omicron is that one? Because from what we know so far, people aren't getting very sick, but I know that could be their specific type of people who we know who have it.
Well, from what I've seen from the people who were infected in South Africa, they were either unvaccinated or partially vaccinated. Now, look, this is nearly changing by the minute, Brendan, yeah. And I'm sure there'll be evidence that some individuals were vaccinated, but maybe they were vaccinated 5-6 months ago. So, and remember, we also have the antivirals coming on stream as well, Brendan. So we have Merck and Pfizer with their particular antivirals, and they're very effective at reducing the hospitalization risk. So, you know, I suppose the key thing we have with regard to the knowns is we know how the non-pharmaceutical measures work.
Yeah.
We need to hit the pause button on the kind of panic. We have a large percentage of the population being boosted. And what we don't know, we will know in about 2 or 3 weeks' time as to kind of how effective it is at evading our protections.
Okay, so we're in this abundance of caution for 2 or 3 weeks anyway while they test it out and all that.
Correct.
Listen, I presume, though, the answer, as always, is vaccines and boosters anyway are part of the answer. Did you see yesterday at City West, there were traffic jams for hours, apparently, and then people getting there and queuing for hours in order to get boosters. Now, I think part of it was an admin thing that they had booked in people and opened up a walk-in at the same time. But at the same time, the images, and it's not the first time we've seen this, people are clamouring to get these boosters, aren't they? And they can't seem to give them to a lot of people who want them.
They are. I think the portal should be just open to everybody above 80. You know, just make it available. We need about 300,000 to 400,000 per week being given so that we can have maximum protection. If it turns out that the vaccines actually work, even if it's in part, Brendan, you remember this debate at the beginning, you know, Pfizer might give you more protection than AstraZeneca, but nonetheless, AstraZeneca still would give you very good protection against hospitalization and serious illness, while maybe not giving you the same protection against being infected. You know, look, what we know for sure is you're better off being vaccinated and boosted than none of the, you know, than not being vaccinated at all. So, and the J&J, I would like to see that move back to 2 months, mirror the CDC image. So we need to get everybody boosted.
Yeah.
It is a better...
But you're academic moving the J&J back to 2 months. If you have the whole cohort in their 50s now who are past their 5 or 6 months, they're not going to get it for another month at least. Everyone's going to be getting it long after they were due their booster at this rate, aren't they?
They possibly are, all right. But we do also, you know, have the capacity maybe to call in the army medics as well. Like, I think we need to throw everything at this just to get it. I mean,
yeah,
some of the data
throw everything
on
at
the
it.
efficacy, again, we go back to Israel, Brendan. We saw that, you know, even after 150 days, so that's 5 months, 10% of their infections were people who were doubly vaccinated. And if you pull it back a little bit more to just 4 months, nearly 5% of the people coming in that were infected were doubly vaccinated. So, you know, I know they've kind of stuck with their 18 months and maybe we'll go back to 5 months. I think we need to go back a little bit further to 4 months.
Yeah, okay.
And then we'll be able to kind of get everybody who was vaccinated since August. The irony is, I suppose, that maybe people who were naturally infected recently might have some additional protections from the other proteins that are present in the virus. So,
okay, Liam, on the local end of things, how do you think it's looking here now? The Mail seemed to be saying today we'll see more restrictions next week. There's talk of this now that it needs to be a 3-month plan, really, in terms of how restricting how we live our lives. Is that appropriate, do you think?
I don't think we need more restrictions. I mean, like, we've seen this actually. Well, one thing I think is that, you know, the advice from NIAC and the CMO needs to be given to government rather than this kind of softening up campaign that we seem to have, you know, and then when government people have already adapted. You know, either we have a quicker and more agile government decision-making process, or NIAC gives their decisions to government directly. That's one thing. But, I mean, the restrictions, you know, I mean, we have so many vaccinated, and we're not going to start the 5 to 12-year-olds vaccinated until probably January. And that's in part due to the logistics of the delivery.
Well,
mid-December,
the first lot of them are coming. But, yeah, you'd wonder about Christmas and everything.
I suppose, you know, without, you know, kind of dissing Christmas, you know, Christmas in an extent is a slight distraction. It's, you know, kind of
no, but what I mean is that if those arrive in the middle of December, you'd wonder, like, remember when the vaccines arrived originally, it was in and around Christmas last year, and it took a week or two to kind of mobilise.
No, we can't have any delays of that. And, you know, the other thing we can't have is any vials going out of date. You know, I mean, anecdotally, you know, there might be some evidence.
We're all hearing of chemists saying that they're throwing it out.
Yeah, and we can't have that. We need, you know, if the portal is open to everybody above 18, then there should be less vials or probably no vials going to waste. We can't afford to have people queuing up and being told, sorry, we sent you the wrong text and you should come back in 2 weeks' time.
Liam, going back to the conversation you were having earlier about kids and stuff, masks is one thing we didn't kind of get into too much there. Should the kids from 9 up be wearing masks in primary school? Is that going to help?
Well, if you look from a purely virological perspective, masks cut down on transmission. Masks cut down on your acquisition of the virus and then infection. So that's no matter what the age. I listened to your three speakers there before I came on, and you know they have kind of covered all what is needed. You know, between, you know, HEPA filters and everything, they're all part of it. And I think it's going to be challenging, though, to kind of keep nine-year-olds having wearing. I'm not saying that they won't be able to do it, and that some will buy into it. But you have a whole spectrum of nine-year-olds of capacity and ability to learn and listen. So I think we have to be, you know, with due regard to kind of the different abilities of people who are in primary school.
Yeah, but I'm sure they'll take that into account. As Tony Holland says, most of the people, most of the time, doing most of the things is as much as we can hope for. Listen, stay with us, Liam. Gabrielle, on the masks thing, I think a lot of people are a little bit upset about this, and in terms of all the stuff we were talking about earlier, developmental stuff and communication, and some kids probably less equipped to wear them than others.
Yeah, I think none of us like the concept of kids wearing masks, and Anne-Marie will be better placed to speak to that developmentally. But we have to look at, you know, the highest rates of transmission are in this age group, and what is different about this age group? They're unmasked in groups and they're unvaccinated. So unfortunately, with the levels of transmission at what they are, if we want to keep schools open and as low risk as possible, we have to look at masking as is outlined for a short period. I hope it's just a couple of weeks or a minimum number of months, because there's no doubt that it has impact on development and it's tougher for some kids than others. But, you know, if we have the majority of kids who can tolerate wearing masks fine, wearing them the most of time indoors, they'll have them off when they're playing outside, they'll have them off when they're out at PE, then that will make a difference to transmission. It's a short-term measure. I wish we didn't have to make it, and I personally wish that the HEPA filters had been in all the classrooms when they went back in September. But I don't think there's any point in sort of, you know, in a pandemic, it's very complex, it's changing. We make the best decisions we can with the information we have at the time. When you have more information, be agile and change. And in many ways, we don't want to be too critical of those making decisions, because that can make them nervous and slower to make decisions. But what we want to see them doing is saying, right, okay, this isn't working as well as we wanted. We're going to try something different. And we sort of have to give a bit of grace around that, so that people have the confidence that they're not just going to be, you know, taken to the cleaners over not getting everything right. Because in fairness, we've gotten an awful lot right in 20 months. But it's clear that the situation, you know, in children is critical at the moment. And for me, keeping in-person learning is so important, because for all children and for all development, but especially for vulnerable children, those schools being open is key to in-person.
Yeah, absolutely. Liam.
Figures to that, you can see that, you know, the value of masks and vaccinations, if you compare the 13 to 18 year olds, there was 3,500 in the last 2 weeks compared to over 11,000 in the 5 to 12 year olds. And that's 18% of the figures compared to just under 6 for the secondary schools. So by the end of January, you know, I would hope that we would have everyone who wants to take it in primary school offered it. And if it's combined with some mask wearing, we should see those numbers collapse down in the 5 to 12 years, and therefore further.
And listen, Liam, like, nobody wants to blame the kids or anything, but I'm going to ask you now, though, if it collapses among them, is it going to bring it down in the community at large as well?
Well, you know, every reduction means that capacity to pass on the infection elsewhere is reduced. And like even having a child in school, the Americans did some studies on it. And, you know, you do have quite an increased prevalence in that household of having COVID come into the household. So, yes, Brendan, yeah, it will bring it down.
I think a lot of people with kids in school feel that they, even if they completely limit their own lives, it's the black swan will come in out of the school then and all their effort is for naught. Like, Anne-Marie, the masks, the psychology of it?
The masks. Yeah, I know people are so worried, or differently worried, different levels of worry about children wearing masks. I suppose I'd agree with Gabrielle that being in school is the most important for their social development. So if that requires wearing a mask to allow them this social environment, so be it. And I know some will have concerns about, you know, language or communication and so on. And I understand those concerns, and they're personal to me as well, actually. But you can get by very well with gestures, you know, with written communication, with exaggerated communication, even with the mask, you know, and they will be able to leave those masks behind when they're outside and for PE.
Yeah, okay.
So if that's what we need, we should absolutely, okay. I think, yeah, it's overdue.
And I presume that it should not be mandatory for all the kids. That, no, there's wriggle room there.
There will be kids who can't, but if most of us do it most of the time.
Yeah, okay. Kevin, what's the... Liam's talking about there about the decision-making process and everything else. Where do you think the politics, the government, the apparatus of state, NPHET and all them, where are they at this weekend? What are you hearing about what's going on there like?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. And Philip Ryan makes this point in a piece in the Sunday Independent as well. Last Tuesday at the cabinet meeting, COVID was not mentioned for the first time in probably an incredibly long time. And he makes the point
that... Were they not meant to talk about antigen tests on Tuesday?
And then they weren't ready for it. And they pulled... There was a memo that had been leaked and widely reported upon about how they were going to do the cheap antigen tests. And then it was pulled at the last minute and didn't happen. And so COVID never made it onto the agenda at all on Tuesday. And this was a slow week for COVID, believe it or not. That's how this was playing out. There was no big excitement about the cabinet subcommittee on Monday night, which was just a scheduled one on economic issues. And then it kind of came to Thursday. And it was, interestingly, a press release came out from Stephen Donnelly in the Department of Health at 10:53 p.m. on Thursday night. Now, when you're getting a press release from the Department of Health at 10:53 at night, you know something is up. And that was expressing the deep concern around this new variant and what was happening in South Africa. And so I think the game has changed completely again. And we don't know the unanswered. The answers, we're back in this place of uncertainty. And that is really difficult for the politicians.
Okay. So do you think they might have been thinking 2 weeks, get the kids to stay at home, blah, 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 people can have some form of a meaningful Christmas? They were in on that delusion with all of us, were they?
I think they were. There was no, all through certainly the first half of the week gone, there was a real sense of calm around. You would speak to ministers, people around government buildings, and they had no sense of catastrophizing.
Yeah,
what
and
was
it
happening.
Seemed that the numbers might be plateauing, hospitals kind of easing up a bit and all that.
Yeah, we hadn't seen, the surge had kind of stopped surging, if you like. It hadn't got incredibly better, but it definitely wasn't getting incredibly worse. And that was what the worry was. So now we find ourselves in a new place where this week coming is going to be quite a busy week, inevitably now. So you will have the cabinet will meet on Tuesday, where they will follow through based on Micheál Martin's comments today with the recommendations around restrictions for children. NPHET likely to meet again on Thursday. And we can expect that is where we're going to get back into this space of talking about bringing back the pub curfew a bit earlier, talking about limiting the number of household restrictions. I don't think we're going to get anywhere towards talking about, you know, county limits or kind of that sense of a lockdown, because I don't think the politicians feel they have the political capital to do that anymore
at this stage. Isn't there? Gabrielle, has the surge got less surgier?
I think we're holding our own in the hospitals in terms of where we are, but I think we need to see the numbers in ICU and the numbers in hospitals coming down before we feel like we've any kind of breathing room, especially going into a Christmas period where, you know, there will be mixing across generation and mixing with hospitals. And obviously, those of us who work in hospitals, we remember well what happened in January last year, so we have the fear about it. But Brendan, while we're on this, and Prof Anning did a really good summary there around the, you know, the variant, I think it's important that we take the points he made really in the context of vaccine equity and where we are globally, because like you said, we don't know yet how this is going to turn out with Omicron. And, you know, the worst case scenario is that it causes higher mortality, or that it's more transmissible or more severe in children or young people, which would be a change for us. But whether or not it ends up being significant or not, and we really don't know, and we'll know over the next 3 to 4 weeks. So it's very much one to sort of stay calm and watch the data. What we do know is that the current situation where the global south just isn't getting vaccines is a breeding ground for this to happen. So it's like playing Russian roulette millions of times. I'm not going to be simplistic.
Vaccine reluctance, hesitancy in South Africa as well. There are vaccines available to people that people won't take down there. There is that aspect to it.
So vaccine hesitancy is one thing, but we have a situation where so many healthcare workers in the global south and so many countries have had so little access to vaccines. Like even before we had vaccines, Brendan, you know, Marie Casey, Susan Smith, Mike Ryan of the World Health Organization, they were all saying we have to ensure that everybody gets vaccinated, not just rich countries. And that's not just because it's the morally right thing to do, but the more people you have infected, every person has millions of copies of the virus replicating. Every time it replicates, you've the opportunity for mutation. And so if we have millions of people, if it's ripping through the global south, we're going to, whether it's this one or another one, we're going to get a mutation that is more transmissible, that is more infectious, and that has vaccine resistance. So what we have to do is we have to increase production. We need the TRIPS waiver. The TRIPS was never intended to be used in the setting of a pandemic. It's actually written into it. And so we just have to do that, because if we don't do this, if we don't change it so that the whole world is getting vaccinated, we're morally bankrupt, but we're actually setting ourselves up for a situation where we end up back to square one. And we can change that by increasing production, helping countries to roll it out. And honestly, if we don't do it, we'll end up with a load of orphans in the global south. That will lead to a load of geopolitical instability. It'll really impact our ability to tackle climate change. And quite frankly, if we don't do this, we're so morally bankrupt as a species, we deserve everything that climate change throws at us.
Yeah, and look, I think a lot of people hope that this is back on the agenda very firmly. Now, should we be taking third doses here and giving it to 5 to 11 year olds?
So I've noticed this in some of the reporting over the week, that it was kind of a choice of, can we boost healthcare workers? Can we give it to children, or can we give it to lower middle income workers? There isn't a single healthcare worker in a lower middle income country that got a booster because we delayed by over a month before we decided to give our ones here. So what we need is the TRIPS waiver. We need to increase production in the factories in the global south that are well able to do it. Many countries, once they get vaccines, will be able to just distribute them. Some of them will need help with the cold chain and supply.
Are there raw materials there and the technology and the people to do this?
So in many countries they have the factories and they have the technology and they can do it. Now there is an issue around some of the reagents of patents, so they'll need to release that as well. But the honest answer is that if there is a will, and the only thing stopping this is protecting global pharma profits, and they're saying that, you know, they put the money into innovation, but actually governments have put a huge amount of funding. It's public money and we deserve it. They had the same argument for HIV and it didn't hold up. They said it would stifle innovation if they released the patents on the antiretroviral therapies. It took 10 years to do that. And you know what? It didn't stifle innovation in HIV at all. So that argument is just grossly redundant. And so I know it sounds like I'm absolutely pleading here, but even if you don't care about people in low and middle income countries, if you care about yourself and you care about our economy, we need to vaccinate the lot of them. And it's well within our gift to do it. Sorry, I've had so little sleep that I'm just emotional about it, and I'm just so frustrated that 20 months into a global pandemic that we're actually just letting it rip through countries and leaving children with orphans, and it's setting ourselves up to be back to square one, and then we'll say, sure, we didn't see it coming. And it's just so ridiculous.
Gabrielle, I've heard a lot of people talk about this in the last 2 weeks, but I think I can certainly say I have never heard it before. But I heard you there, and I think everyone heard you. Liam, I presume you'd go along with all of that?
Oh, I would. I don't think I could offer a word that would kind of be of a, you know, add to what has been said that would be of value.
Yeah.
No, I think, I mean, you just did mention the point about kind of, you know, boosters. Well, I suppose, I think this has been shown to be a three-shot vaccine, certainly from the RNA vaccine's perspective. So I suppose you could say to complete the course, we need at least three vaccines. So, you know, if we need three, the countries in the Southern Hemisphere need three as well. Like, so, you know, I think we're going to be looking at this and other types of vaccines. I mean, the French have a nice inactivated adjuvant virus, which will probably give more protection again. So, you know, there is a portfolio of vaccines that can be spread around the world. some of them actually more easily transported than the RNA vaccines. So, you know, okay. I think your last speaker makes...
So we could be doing a lot more here. And you know what? That is an exhausted healthcare worker, exhausted after 2 years of this and 2 years of being the goalkeeper for a lot of other people's problems and everything else, and being there on the front line of it and not talking about herself or her own problems or her colleagues, but just thinking about the broader humanity there. Now, look, speaking of boosters, we go from the global to the local. Siobhan Pearsons is on the line. Siobhan, you tried to go to City West for your booster this morning. What happened?
Well, we were there of the M7 at about 8:45, and it was just taking hours to get in. So we took our granddaughter with us, who's 19, and had the Janssen vaccination, so she would be able to get it after 3 months. So we thought we would try. Both of us are in our 60s. We haven't got the text to say, you know, we have an appointment. So you had
an appointment today?
No, we haven't.
Okay. No. Oh, you haven't got your appointment yet. Sorry, no. Yeah, I misheard you. Yeah,
you know the one. Yeah, yeah, from the over 60s one. We haven't got that. So we decided we would chance this morning.
Okay.
Eventually, my granddaughter and myself got out of the car and walked the last half mile. We then arrived into a queue, and after about 15 minutes, they told us that it was the wrong queue, that they were the walk-ins were in one side, and then the appointments were in the other. And then after about 40 minutes queuing, and there were lots of people. People are obviously very keen to get the booster. There were lots and lots of people. A chap came down and told us that it was going to take 3.5 to 4 hours because they were going to take the appointments first. So we left and we walked out, and we still had to walk to my husband, who still hadn't got in, and we decided we would try it again. Apparently, they're going to open it now for 7 days.
So okay. What were the opening hours today? Do you know, Siobhan? What were the opening hours today when you checked?
Well, you see, the website isn't always accurate, I don't think, because it said that it was 60 to 69-year-olds in the morning. This morning, and then appointments in the afternoon. At least that's what I understood. But it does seem a little bit crazy to be doing both.
Yeah.
You know, walk-ins and appointments.
So
and
basically, anyone who went down there this morning, keen to get their booster and do the right thing by everybody, a 4 hour wait where they even got there eventually, which took hours in itself.
Yeah. Well, we decided it wasn't worth the risk that we might, queue for 4 hours and then not get the vaccination.
Yeah.
So we'll try again. I appreciate everybody's doing their best, but it just seemed a bit chaotic. And I read reports about it being the same yesterday.
Yeah. Okay. Siobhan Pearson, thanks very much for letting us know about that. And fridges and fridges full of millions of them in the country, as far as we know. Okay, we'll take a break. Professor Liam Fanning, thank you very much for your insights there. And our panel are staying with us, Gabrielle Collar and Kevin Doyle and Anne-Marie Craven. We'll go to a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, welcome back. Our panel are still with us, Gabrielle Collar and Kevin Doyle and Anne-Marie Craven. And a lot of people texting in about what Gabrielle was saying there about vaccines earlier. Fair play to Gabrielle for speaking up so eloquently from the heart. She's spot on. That's from Mick in Galway. Thank you for bringing human emotion and a moral compass to what has drifted into an inappropriately technical conversation. Thank you for reminding us what really matters, and thank you for what you and your colleagues do. And that's from Paula Downey. Now, let's go from the sublime to the ridiculous, although I'd be afraid to call Garth Brooks the ridiculous because it would mark me out as an urban sneerer, even though I'm more agricultural and rural than half the people going to Garth Brooks. But anyway, Kevin Doyle, the two Irelands is reflected across a lot of pieces in the papers today. But there was a piece, who was a piece in the Sunday World about this?
Eddie Rowley is all over this stuff. Loves it.
Roy Curtis, though, has a piece. Brooks, like the Healy Rays, or anyone who eats their dinner during the day, is their vision of hell. By day, I presume he means the metropolitan sitting in studios like this. So, yeah, two Irelands.
And you know what, Brendan? I'm conscious that we spent 45 minutes talking about something that has dominated all our lives for so long. And I'm conscious too that some people see Garth Brooks as another headache. But do you know what? It's the only bit of good news you can find in the paper today is if you read about it, right? People dropped more than 30 million euro buying up tickets to go to Garth Brooks concerts in the space of a few hours earlier this week. And fair play to them, because why not? Life is tough enough.
400,000 people,
400,000 people there.
So like if we take the population's 5 million, I'd say are 2 million of them under 18 maybe? So like... what is it? It's practically like 15% of the population.
There's
only 7 or 8 people in Ireland are going to these
Pretty much, if you don't know somebody going to Garth Brooks, you have a very, very small pool of friends, is basically what it concludes. And, you know, it's interesting. Barry Egan has an interview with Peter Aiken, and he's kind of talking about how Peter Aiken at 5 a.m. last Thursday morning rang Bob Doyle in Nashville, no relation, obviously. Because at that stage in the morning, and tickets didn't go on sale till 8, he could already tell that the two concerts they had announced wasn't going to do it. And so it was at 5 a.m. in the morning, even before people had started getting any tickets, that they made the decision to go
Ireland
all the way.
Ireland had spoken.
The drive for 5 was already happening at that stage of the morning. Now, of course, they being... promoters, they didn't tell people that until they had stayed in the queue, and gradually over the course of the morning they kept adding the tickets onto it. Look, it's extraordinary. It's inexplicable. From all I've read and understand of it, Garth Brooks doesn't have this anywhere else. These are his only concerts upcoming in Europe.
My brother was on to me from America going, what the hell is going on in Ireland? Like, and I said, does he not play stadiums over there? He's on a stadium tour. And he was saying, no, I think he plays stadiums in Eastern Europe. No, he was being mean. I'm sure Garth Brooks is still huge in America. Like, he sang at Biden's inauguration, didn't he?
And still big, like, but probably doesn't have the worship that he gets from people.
He's not getting 15% of the population going to the kids.
Certainly not. But look, so be it. And you know what? To the haters, go away and get a life. Let people off. I'm not going. I've no interest in going to Garth Brooks. I'd much prefer if Bruce Springsteen could sell 5 nights in Croker. But so what? Like, if I really don't understand the people who hate on it, because if it's not for you, turn it off.
Exactly. Yeah, ignore it. It's hard to ignore it at times.
Although that is fair. I think
we can ignore it again and know it's actually happening. Apart from, of course, the poor people of living around the Croke Park area who, like, they suddenly got drowned out in it all, didn't they?
They did this time. There was a much more kind of subtle build up to it this time than last time, where they were just kind of slapped with 5 concerts all of a sudden. They did the paperwork this time, got their ducks in a row. And you're right, they have been a bit drowned out, but you're up against that wave of public opinion.
400,000 people who need to get out of
the house. They held them out for 8 years. That wasn't bad going.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an extraordinary interview with Vicky Phelan in the Sunday Times today, and it's tied in, Anne-Marie, with a campaign that the Sunday Times are starting, which is to give people the right to... assisted dying, is that the phrase we would use?
Yeah, assisted dying is the name of the bill. And, you know, I just think Vicky Phelan has done an amazing amount for healthcare in Ireland, and she's been such an advocate that if she is raising something like this, we need to give her the time and need to respect that and listen to it. I know it's a difficult conversation to have, and I know it will be had in more detail next year where a bill is discussed on that. But I think it's amazing that she can still give the time to raising that issue now, because it's not something anyone wants to talk about, and it's something that is sad. But it obviously is something that's very important for a particular group of people. So I think it does deserve consideration, even though we probably all have complex feelings about it.
But I think that there are ways of doing it, Gabrielle. Am I right? There are ways of implementing this where you have a lot of safeguards involved. And they're generally, in other countries, haven't been huge issues around it.
So I have a lot of concerns about this. And
do you?
Yeah, I do. And one of the reasons I have is, if you look at Canada, they brought this in for terminal illness. So exactly what Vicky is advocating for. And it's very hard to argue against anything Vicky says when you look at the tough situation she's in, you know. But at the same time, if I put on my physician hat, and I'm always coming from a perspective of
is not going to take any of this personally.
Not at all,
or
but I'm always thinking, how is it going to be for vulnerable people and people who can't advocate for themselves? And in Canada, within 5 to 7 years, they went from terminal illness only, which is what is being talked about here, to chronic diseases not terminal, including those with psychiatric illness and no physical illness at all. So given our dysfunctional and long waiting lists,
I would be really concerned
that, you know, people be in a situation where they'd be offered assisted suicide without having been offered all the appropriate management of their physical and mental illness, given the lack of access we have. So I have a lot of concerns about it. But like Anne-Marie says, I think, you know, the discussion that needs to be had needs to really take that safeguarding in. And I had huge safeguarding concerns around this bill because, no, Brendan, I don't think two doctors is anywhere near enough in the context of vulnerable people and coercion, because it is so hard to prove coercive control, to pick up on it. And elderly people, say that have a house and don't want that house to be used to pay for a nursing home because the property ladder is so hard to get onto for their kids, that you could have a woman of 80 going, well, do you know what, if I go now, the kids will have this for deposit for their own houses. So we've huge issues around access to health and access to housing.
Is there a way of doing this at all, do you think, that might give the likes of Vicky Phelan a choice about how she wishes to go, which she is going to go anyway? Is there a way of doing that, do you think? Or you're suggesting open that door?
My personal opinion is, when I look at Canada and look at other countries where they brought it in, that it's a slippery slope that leaves vulnerable people very vulnerable. And so I personally don't think so. I totally accept that there are valid alternative arguments, and this is a conversation that is going to take place in the country. But always my perspective on it is, what about vulnerable people? What about, I'd be really uncomfortable about people with mental illness being offered this, who haven't had access to a psychiatrist, to psychology, to social work, to all the supports that they need. And that, for me, in the context of our dysfunctional system, is the big red flag in this.
Okay, and that is a hot potato discussion, though, that is it is going to happen over the next few years.